You're listening to Architecture Masters.
We said yes to most things, actually. Right. You take any project, any site, you can produce a wonderful piece of architecture. Okay, my name is Mary Duggan, founder of Mary Duggan Architects.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Is this Shoreditch then, or the practice in Hoxton? I never quite...
Shoreditch?
No, which area?
That's what we like to say.
Yeah, okay. On the programme this week is architect Mary Duggan. In 2004, Mary and her then partner, Joe Morris, founded Duggan Morris Architects, which quickly went on to become one of the most critically acclaimed young practices. Over the intervening 12 years, the practice grew from just a team of two to finally employing more than 50 staff. The rapid success of the business also coincided with the practice winning a huge number of architectural awards. Earlier this year, the practice announced an amicable demerger, with Joe continuing to lead Duggan Morris, whilst Mary, along with 9 members of staff, went on to launch a new practice, Mary Duggan Architects. I joined Mary in her new practice in Shoreditch, where I asked about the nature of creative partnerships, about convincing clients, and dealing with practice growing pains. But we started by wondering just how many awards she'd won in her time at Duggan Morris Architects.
Gosh, did we? I'm sure we've counted them and written that number.
I don't
number
know whether I'm out of date, but
right. A lot, yeah. There's a...
So BD said you'd won at Duggan Morris 9 Reber Awards, the Mansa Medal, Stephen Lawrence Prize,
yes.
2 nominations for the Miles van der Rohe European Prize. I'm sure there are lots of other awards
there was a few. Well, I don't know whether you're allowed to say it anymore, but a few sterling mid lists, long lists.
And where?
Lots of accolades.
And a lot of those accolades, certainly the RIBA awards are, as you know, from being on the awards jury now. It's architects selecting those, so it's kind of by architects.
Yeah.
So I guess for a long time, Duggan Morris was the architect's architect, I guess you'd say, a real kind of.
It was what was always interesting for me, and Joe and I as business partners always had a very different perspective on this, but I never felt, and I say this without wanting to be judged, but particularly excited about receiving an award.
Yeah.
I always felt that it was important to be recognised and for people to see your work. And there are many ways that you can get your work seen through press, through social media. But I think within the industry, the awards programme really is very important. And there's a lot of cynicism about how those juries are put together and how the judging process works. But actually, having sat on a number of those, it is a genuine consideration about professionalism and how one receives a brief and how one takes that and executes a design process and delivers a building. I think one shouldn't be cynical about the number. Maybe we have reported the number, and I think the number is sort of irrelevant. I think the irrelevant fact is that there were projects that architects considered to be important and well executed in a context that's complicated.
And what stage do you think the award is won? You know, is it a case of it's a clever concept, which you've worked through,
mm-hmm.
or is it a case of in the kind of the iterations that you've been through, or?
I think it's it's getting to the point where you actually able to deliver something that you really believe in and being quite fearless about the building that you want to procure. So take, and Doug and Morris were really good at that, just being brave and saying to a client, this is a fantastic design concept. Take Alfriston Swimming Pool, the project with the sort of folded roof structure. We sat on numerous steering committees and spoke to parent governors, and a parent governor would say, surely this building would be cheaper with a flat roof. We say, well, of course it would be.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a building that you want your school to move forward. You want to, you're talking about change. You're talking about generating revenue out of a standard school programme. So why not go for this? You're raising funding. What's, in that context, what's better about a flat roof? And we tended to get a buy-in through sheer kind of, not belligerence, but a belief that, that the building that we've designed would change things. And it did. That school generated, they almost covered the cost of the building within the first year.
By getting external, by it being a destination.
By it being a destination, by considering that it needs to be an important building, recognised within the local area. It isn't a London-centric project. And just generating some interest in the school as a whole. And there are actually, they've recommissioned Mary Duggan actually to do a similar project on the site, which is a performing arts building with the same ambition to generate revenue for the school, to bring in other theatre groups to take part in that briefing process.
And that, you're talking about revenue there, yeah, so from a client's perspective, thinking about money,
yeah.
Which I guess is sometimes thought of for award-winning buildings as not going hand in hand with award-winning buildings, yeah, thinking about the cost and everything else.
Yeah, I think it's, yes, I think architects should bring something to the table that a client was absolutely not expecting. You know, if you want a generic building delivered at a square metre rate and you can plug it into an Excel sheet and everything looks hunky-dory.
They're not going to choose...
Don't choose Doug or many other architects out there, because most of us want to come to the table with great ideas. And that's not just great ideas about form, you know, fancy shapes, for want of a better word, but interesting ways that you can procure a building and make a building work for you. I mean, for a school to build a building that generates them revenue, that goes back into the school, enables them to build more, is, I think that's a really clever business plan. And it takes a very, you know, it takes a head teacher who understands business to do that. There are many schools that don't have those sorts of characters, which is a great shame.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you set up Doug and Morris in 2004.
Yes.
And fairly quickly started winning awards. At what stage? But
it's,
I'm wondering really when you realised that there was something special about the practice and special about you as architects. Yeah, plenty of people go through their whole kind of architectural careers.
Yeah.
And don't win anything like the number of awards that the practice has won.
Mm.
So you must at some stage have... It occurred to you, I'm wondering at what stage
I suppose there is a point where you, we realise that the work was good, well received. We were getting invited to do competitions. People would come. I mean, when you're on the inside, it's and you're stressed out of your brains and you're trying to work out if you're making enough money and you're trying to get staff, keep staff happy and put them on the right projects.
Yeah.
You see things in a different way. And every now and then someone will step in from the outside and say, wow, how the hell did you deliver that building? And then you think, it was really, really hard.
Yeah.
But I don't... Maybe I'm different. Joe certainly had a different view on this, but I don't think you ever think, how great am I? Or we're doing something that no one else is capable of doing. But you certainly you certainly gain some momentum from the success and the sort of reported, you know, excellence or I don't know what the right word is that others see in your work.
Right.
For me personally, I'm very happy at the point in a project where you know you've got a really strong concept that's come together and you just want to make sure you can deliver that. And I think there are architects who become completely inflexible at a point where they've got something. And I think it's important that you kind of retain this image. You get to a range of concept design and you're happy, but you realise that there's still a bit of flex in it.
Yeah.
And I think if you're not
too happy to make
that's
changes,
not that you're going to change a faulted roof to a flat roof or something like that, but you have the ability to still be nimble. Your work isn't done because you've imagined a beautiful model or a beautiful image.
But
you
have to
deliver it.
Taking that vaulted roof as an example, that's something you've fought for within a project in order to keep. And in terms of making money for a practice, fighting for things like that, it's going to be more work for you. It's going to be there's a decision to be made there in terms of in terms of making money as a practice, in terms of how much you're going to.
Yeah. There's always an easy route.
Yeah.
I think but that particular project, Alfriston School, I think we commenced working on it at maybe 2008.
Okay.
So it's quite early on actually that we won that commission.
Right.
And it just went quiet. There was a sort of almost 3-year fundraising program.
Right.
And then we came back to it and saw it through. No, we've never been the sort of practice that would make a compromise because it would reduce our resources or make a project much easier to deliver.
Or
more profitable. No.
Okay.
No, that has never happened.
So we're jumping back a little bit. You studied in Brighton.
Yeah.
Architecture. A regular architecture degree.
It was Brighton Polytechnic at the time.
Okay.
I was born in London, brought up in London, and I just wanted to leave London. You know, most people are coming in. I just had to get out. I didn't want to live at home anymore. Being in London, one thing you can do is get up, walk around, get from A to B without relying on cars, and I just like the idea that I could go to Brighton and walk everywhere. I could walk from the architecture school was in Mithras House, still is. I could walk from there to the town.
Okay. Before Brighton, did you family architects or are they? How were you?
No, actually.
How were you? How were you kind of?
It was
brought into architecture
through schooling and interests I developed at school. My dad, in his latter years, started to do very small scale development. So I was exposed to building sites a lot.
Yeah.
And every now and then, an architect or a building control officer, I'd get dragged to a building site with my dad to meet someone to discuss, I don't know, a fire lobby or something.
Okay.
So I became interested because I saw the building actually work, and you know, most of my family are kind of Irish farmers or have come to London and have become tradesmen. So I was very much exposed to
the trades.
Okay. Not so much design. The design came, I think, genuinely came out of my own interests and creativity that came out through a kind of normal state school curriculum.
Wow, okay. And then you had a couple of years teaching.
Yes, I went to Penang and I taught in a English speaking school, majority Chinese students. Architecture. It was a school that educated their students to diploma level, so it would be up to year 2 degree.
Okay.
What happened was De Montfort University, many years ago, they're not still running it anymore, they set up a twinning program.
Yeah.
And I was invited to go out and teach on that course.
Okay.
The idea being that they would run a De Montfort University program and those students could then go over to their course many years ago.
And you've been, I mean, we're kind of jumping around a bit now, but you're an external examiner now with...
At Brighton, which is great. It's really interesting to see how much the school has changed. Same location, but completely different agenda. They run a unit structure, so they have design tutors taking on a number of students, whereas when I was there, it was an open with one programme.
Right. And the teaching, you know, having a grounding in teaching and how people learn, obviously any small practice has, you know, a lot of architectural assistants coming in who perhaps have not picked up some of the more, say, some of the more technical details.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, how much do you feel you're sort of teaching in a practice, you know, in terms of, I'm just wondering if that's partly a help in the practice, isn't it?
A little bit. I think what I got out of it more was perhaps an exposure to how people and how willing certain students and now employees are to open up and talk about design and table ideas.
Yeah.
You know, from dialogue to put some sketches on the table or build a model, no matter how ugly, and just put it in front of me.
Yeah.
I think you can, there's some confidence that comes out of talented students and employees that isn't always, you know, about how well they're able to talk about their scheme. Like, you know, I learned then that actually the most amazing student I had didn't ever speak in class. Okay. She would just take it all in, eyes wide open, go home and bring in the most beautiful models, beautiful drawings. And she was, you know, very capable of designing. But I think not in a way that we... Unfortunately, in London, I think that the most successful architectural practices are probably the practices that are able to talk themselves up, deliver a lecture, be very convincing, convince a commercial client that, they've done a REBA stage report, which is as... you know, as thick as a brick, and that means, and talk them through it page by page, and that means something that doesn't always mean there's a great piece of work there. It just means just delivered what they signed up to doing, which is a chunky document with all the right.
So 2 years, came back to London, 2 years at the Bartlett.
Yeah.
And then teaching again?
No, I didn't. I did a short stint at the Bartlett, only 4 years ago, I think.
Right.
But I stepped away. I worked in a number of practices. I was really, really keen to design, but to get projects to site and understand what it is to deliver buildings. Yeah. And most of my career pre-Doug Morris was spent at a practice called Gulliver Langston Architects, and they had great, you know, I'm forever grateful for their confidence in me. They threw me into building projects. They believed that I could do it, and I made some grand mistakes. And they were great mentors, really great mentors.
What sort of size were the practice then?
When I started, it was just three of us, actually, and the practice grew to about maybe 15 by the time I left and set up Doug and Morris with Joe.
So an experience there of growing a practice, from someone else's practice.
Yeah, handling people, understanding, you know, on reflection, I could see that they could see or pick people with an appetite to do things and get on with the job, were confident enough just to put themselves out there.
What was I'm interested really in that there's a lot of architects who are happy sometimes to stay in big, 1,000, 2,000 person practices to run fairly big jobs. And there seems a different group who want to set up by themselves.
Yeah.
What do you think is the kind of driving factor for people
to go one way or the other?
Wanting to do their own thing. What was it that, you know, drove you to leave the practice you were at and then to set up?
Certainly the opportunity was there to win work. I was aware of that.
Right. This was sort of 2000, that was 2004, 2000, so before,
yeah,
before the recession.
I was 30, God, I felt quite old at the time, but 33, and I probably built and overseen probably 8 or 9 projects at that point, which is a lot compared to... And that was a lot to do with the scale of the practice and the trust they had in me to be able to be involved in and oversee other people building out some quite small, some big, but, you know, never really big, never more than, you know, we're talking almost 15 years ago now, but nothing bigger than 5 million. Okay. But with that scale of project, you do get to do absolutely everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was really good exposure. But what drives people? I think... Wanting to be in control of... I guess you get to the point where you've built so many things. I was confident that I could take those skills and see the things that I wanted to get built
right.
with my own details, with my own design ideas.
So some of it is it a style thing, that things that you want to incorporate into buildings get taken out when you're in another practice, or someone's got a different design idea?
Yes, or sometimes you just don't quite find the practice that's close enough to your own agenda. You know, I've interviewed people who have said, I love your design process, it's absolutely what I'm interested in, and I can see myself fitting in here. And when I hear those words, I just think, well great.
Yeah.
Because the worst thing is trying to be professional, trying to draw and design and do your due diligence on details or architecture that actually you don't like very much.
Yeah.
I think that's very hard.
But almost a bonus for you, having worked somewhere where there was perhaps slightly that mismatch, otherwise maybe you don't.
Yeah,
you don't.
Although it didn't feel like a mismatch. It just felt like I could probably take all those, the skill and knowledge, and do my own thing with it.
Okay.
It wasn't absolutely not a desire to make money.
No.
But maybe just give it a go and see what I do on my own.
Right.
Or at that time with Joe Morris.
And that, so maybe, I mean, coming on to that setting up, talked to a lot of people who set up originally by themselves, and a lot of people with a partner.
Yeah.
And a lot of, architecture, I suppose, is full of names, you know, Farrell and Grimshaw, Rogers and Piano, Duggan and Morris, you know, people who've worked together, and then he was a creative kind of pairing.
Yeah.
How important is it for two people setting up a practice to share to have a shared creative vision? Or is it important that they have is that kind of creative tension, you know, part of what creates awards and creates?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that you get on.
Right.
You're able to have a conversation and you have complementary skills.
Right.
Because I think on the design front, you find your feet. I wouldn't say that Joe Morris and I came together with this great idea about wanting to sort of procure a very particular type of architecture. But we definitely knew we could work together.
Yeah.
We got on. At the time, we were partners, so that was a sort of no-brainer at that point. And we both had the appetite for it. In hindsight, we were both quite good at building.
Yeah.
He'd had a lot of build experience as well. And he was very good at communicating, good at the sort of front end stuff.
Yeah. Right.
Very convincing. He could, and you know, still can do a very convincing presentation.
Right.
And then in the background, I suppose I was sort of beavering away, drawing, thinking quite hard and overthinking things. You know, deliver really good ideas in drawings and...
Being slightly more client-facing.
Yes. Well, I suppose... So we have very complementary skills. Definitely together worked on design, together worked on the sort of how we were going to present and convince. But I suppose the bias was Joe very good at presenting front end. He just has that skill.
Yeah.
And I was more, I suppose, leaning on the drawing and the design. But that's not to say that each other are bad at the other, but one is better than the other. And I think that's, you know, it's difficult when you've got someone who's that good. And I've had conversations with many other practices with two directors. If you've got one that's really good, then you have to put them in front of the client. If it's about winning the job, then you need them to win the job, and that's it. But
do you think that affects the type of client you pick up, you know, in terms of that assured presentation? Do you think there's something about a different clients that respond differently to a slightly quieter, slightly more measured?
Yes, I do. And I think that's... It's a very noticeable... When we demerged, the conversation about... which projects would transfer to my practice. It was a very easy one. You know, it was amicable. It was easy because it was obvious which projects and which clients I got on better with.
Right.
And the clients that have transferred over to me are the ones who we're designing houses for, the Science Museum, and a few others that the clients are filmmakers or one really interesting project with a composer. And the conversation with them is, it's never to a board. It's never come in, you need to convince this panel that we've given you the correct instructions. There's no show. It's just, we're having a conversation in a room like you and I, and I really believe in this piece of work.
Right.
So it's those relationships I'm better at, and I'm much happier to sort of move forward with.
Okay.
And usually the clients who are just interested in design, they're not interested in proving that the design is progressing, but that it's been de-risked.
Right.
That there's numbers that need to be on a spreadsheet with a bottom line that ticks another box. I guess I'm more interested in design process now.
You started Mary Duggan Architects. Is there a vision for where you want that to go? You know, you're now, what, 9 people?
9, yes. Okay.
And is that a number you're comfortable with? Do you want, you're looking for, in terms of, Duggan Morris, what sort of size?
50. Grew to 50 in a very...
So 50 is a... I guess you can still know everyone's name at 50. You kind of vaguely know what people are doing.
Almost. It's in medium large, isn't it?
Yeah.
Duggan Morris. So when we demerged, Duggan Morris were doing very, very big projects.
Yeah.
Workplace and housing, predominantly. Yeah. I'm very good at it.
Yeah.
You know, so it had evolved from a practice that had small teams working together, ones, twos, threes, to a practice with teams of 5, 6, 7.
Mm-hmm. And that's several separate teams working.
And it's there was always an ambition to have a sort of very open, very inclusive design process, open dialogue. Mm. So, for example, a project leader on one project would step into another and take part in that discussion, share knowledge, and that worked really, really well. It became so big that it was very difficult to see everything. It was very difficult to see all of the details, to understand what everyone was doing at any one time. I mean, it gets to the point where it's just impossible. And as a director, you have to resign yourself to skimming across the surface, which is fine. Many practices do that. And you get to a point as a director where you can just, you know, if you love a particular project, you can just delve a bit deeper and make sure you're more involved. But I personally found it very hard to let go of the hands-on, to not be part of the discussions about model making, not really interrogate the architecture. Because at that level, you talk about the architecture, but you also talk about the square meter rates. You also talk about how you're going to present that stuff to a client and convince them. And with these particular clients who were, you know, having to prove that every single decision they're making is the right one. It's a commercial word, and a commercial one. I don't mean commercial. It's not a dirty word, but it's just a reality. I felt that there was too much of that going on, at maybe at the expense of, you know, another few months of design process that might turn a project from really, really good into a exemplar.
Yeah.
It started to really niggle me. So when we demerged, I just felt, well, this is my opportunity to not do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, work on these smaller projects where I can, you know, if I want to get a bit of clay and knead it into the shape of a building that I'm interested in, I can do that and not worry so much about holding up a mushy piece of clay to a guy in a suit with lots of hair gel. You know, it's sort of, you know, I'm joking now, but I think what I've learned is that there are architects who can do commercial architecture very, very well. It's an absolute that you need to be convincing, that you need to produce great design and talk about it. But you can't hide from the numbers. You can't hide from, you know, that the kind of very stereotypical professional side of it. You have to be seen to be that, because you're an important person in this investment. And it's so important that there are great architects out there that do that and manage to deliver good design. And there are many small practices who really want that, who look up and just, you know, R7 building that's just finished in King's Cross, it's fantastic. And I look at it and I just think, wow, that's amazing that we've achieved that. But I know how hard the architects at the front end have had to work to get every single detail that they wanted. So I now want to do nice work. I want to be calm. You know, I'm in my mid-40s. I know that, you know, I can say that I don't want to do those really big projects that need so much emotional investment in the in the bits that you don't love doing, but you have to to do.
And it can be profitable, can it? Yeah, they're kind of 10, 12, 15 sort of practice.
Yeah, it's harder. I mean, what I have learned is the practice of 50, you know, it goes without saying, a bigger project in a firm that's established for 12 years has learned how to resource well, effectively, can start to generate money. And absolutely, Doug Morris is very capable of doing that.
Yeah.
Successfully. It's harder when you drop from a 20 million scheme to a 500,000 scheme. You have to think very hard about and that I feel like I've gone backwards in a way. You know, I'm thinking again about efficiency, but I've obviously taken a lot from Doug and Morris, and you know, I can read people now. I can see in someone's eyes if they've got the appetite for something. There's a lot. Whilst I'm a new practice, I'm not a young practice. I have demerged, you know, arguably I've split from Doug and Morris, so I'm not starting from scratch. I've just got to make sure of that knowledge and legacy works for me.
Some of those, in a 50-person practice, is presumably someone doing more full-time on business development or on marketing, communications. When you move to a smaller practice, then that's having to be shared out a little bit more.
Yeah.
The kind of HR and things again.
Yeah.
I know some people really don't like the sort of HR aspects, and other people really, really love that, you know, in terms of how you engage your staff and how you keep them motivated. And
yeah, that's really hard, actually. I think it's hard at 50 and it's hard at 9.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to be said about just choosing the right people and making sure that there's a studio dynamic, the right characters, the right mix of skills.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you might build a team that work well together. They, you know, if you're lucky, they socialise together. That's the nature of architecture. Yeah. Most
long hours
and
but time shared in the interests park. And things.
Yes. So people, yeah. But then when you've got projects that need different skill sets, sort of moving around alongside that, it becomes quite difficult. So I really want to have a great studio. I want there to be a lot of conversation within the practice. So rather than what happened at Doug and Morris, everyone did a bit of everything when we were small. And as the practice grew, for lots of reasons, you have to pull people together in packs. And the conversation between the two is you handpick someone who'll move into another group. Yeah. I want my studio to have more of that. Everyone's looking. I want one person to own a project, but for there to be a live conversation about what we're making.
When you've got several teams within a bigger practice that way, inevitably, I guess, as directors having to make decisions about moving people between projects and making compromises maybe about who you put on which project and which staff. Yeah, that's, I suppose, as a smaller practice, then, you know, those decisions are, you're not having to kind of...
No, you can... So I can see everything. I can stand up and I can see the studio, and that's such a relief to me now, having come out of a 50-man practice. I couldn't see everything. I didn't know. I might have had a resourcing meeting the week before, but I didn't really know who was working on which project. And we had to start putting people in bays so the teams were together, which is a sensible, practical decision. But that's how I knew.
People sat.
In my studio, everyone is on everything and aware of what everyone else is doing and contributing to it. So that's a breath of fresh air, actually.
And so that, there's no ambition in terms of ambition of size, similar sorts of...
I think at Doug and Morris we got, I think it was 15 where, and that was with two of us. After 15, it became hard. I remember thinking, wow, it's different at 20 compared to 15. Yeah. It felt busier.
Talk to a lot of people about the kind of growing pains, really.
Staff started falling out with each other around about that size. That those sorts of funny things start to happen.
I think back to Doug and Morris days, a lot of the work was in London. It'd be mostly London work.
Yeah, very local, actually. We said yes to most things, actually. And that was our attitude. Let's take on a project. There's always an opportunity there. And there is, absolutely, architecturally, take any project, any site, you can produce a wonderful piece of architecture. Yeah. But in between the project and delivering it as a client, there are numbers, there are all sorts of things that are very make it very hard.
Okay.
So we learnt some lessons.
I'm wondering about that. You're from London originally, doing a bulk of your work in London.
Yes, it's so Science Museum. I've got a lovely house in Somerset, very close to Bruton. Two further houses in London. I am born in London, but Irish.
Right. Okay.
So I'm keen to try and get some work in Ireland.
Right.
You know, I love it there. I've got most of my family is there. I visit there a lot. I've designed houses for cousins. I guess I'm more interested in cultural placemaking residential projects now. So that's really where I want to take the practice.
Talked a little bit then earlier on about kind of inspiration and sort of where your early ideas came from. Mm-hmm. The original, say, there's a house style originally for Doug and Morris.
Was that part of a
house style? Did you recognise a? You might walk along and spot an AHMM building, and you might.
I had a conversation with a journalist about this, actually. They said, yeah, I think I could spot a Doug and Morris building.
Right.
And I said, well, what is that? Yeah. How and what is that? And, you know, there are things that we did as a practice. There was one idea that sort of moved from through a number of projects, which is a sort of very heavy masonry building with sort of jewels. So Brentford Lock West, for example, is a masonry structure, and a lot of work went into sort of pin these very delicate and very deep projected balconies onto the front. Yeah. I love that sort of idea that you take a piece of London, you take the vernacular, and then you kind of put earrings on it, or you know, you sort of add a frill. But we talked a lot about the sort of heavy London fabric, you know, and working in London, you do get immersed. I mean, there's no denying it. You meet a planning officer, they want to know that you have interrogated the context, the history, and they want to understand what you're doing with it. Yeah. So inevitably you get involved in an interpretation.
Right. I think the more you do in London, the more you convince people that you get London.
But it's interesting because the more you do it, you know, as long as you're not doing into pastiche, the more you look, the more you know, there's so much to learn from architecture. It's this amazing collage of wonderful details and structures. And so we really enjoyed that, but we liked sort of, you know, adding a frill here and there, which sort of usually came from a kind of obsession with a particular detail that there would then be a subtle twist to it.
And anything then you wish would change, you know, if you had the opportunity, you know, given a fairy godmother that could come
in
and
would, I think the government should buy all diesel engines and put them somewhere else. One thing, I've been to Ireland a lot recently, and it's unbelievable the difference in the air quality. I'm very aware of it now. You know, I have my nitrogen oxide monitor. I can see it, and I can now breathe it. And that just needs to change. There are a number of respiratory conditions that are exacerbated by it, and it just amazes me that there isn't a program to just get rid of it. We know it's bad. Yeah. It's, you know, we have an entitlement to fresh air, just like we have an entitlement to clean water.
Yeah.
You know, and a sewage system. Yeah. This is the air. You know, we're walking in it. We need to breathe it. It needs to be clean.
Absolutely. You were out cycling. Did you do the pedal?
Yes, I did the pedal.
I'm trying to catch up with Anna Lee. Did Anna Lee?
Oh,
Anna Lee,
yes.
She cycled as well.
She was amazing, Anna Lee. Which, I mean, there are so many strong women out there. I can't. So Anna Lee did it. Sadie Morgan, another incredibly strong woman. I don't know where the strength comes from. And I mean physical strength.
Yeah.
I just said I'd do it when Jennifer Ross set up Pedal about 5 years ago, and I've just been putting it off. And this year in January she asked me again, and I just had this thing that I would commit. I'd commit to doing that, and I committed to doing something else equally ridiculous at the time. But I trained and did it, and it was a challenge. I'm not
just, I mean, I was, what, just Padel, for people listening, is...
is a cycle from this year. It was a cycle from Porto to Lisbon, 500 kilometres, roughly 150, 160 a day, raising money for Cora, predominantly a child adoption charity, and various others.
And the inspiration is, I guess, from cycle to MIPIN?
Definitely, yeah. But it's women only, which is quite funny, because what I guess the difference is there's less kilometres in a day, less of us doing it, and it isn't all about Mars bars at the breaks. There's quite a lot of healthy food. And yeah, really good fun, really good fun. And it's networking in the way that the Cycle to Cannes is networking. This is also a networking event.
I was interested, really. The kind of Brompton is the sort of architect, almost become the kind of architect staple for moving around cities now. There seems to be something about cycling which appeals to architects.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I'm not quite sure why or what.
But so the train, I agree. I think there is something about certain sports. I think cycling is one of them.
Yeah.
Climbing is another sort of a sport that more architects seem to do. I think it's got a lot to do with the kit and the sort of nerdiness about all of the components, perhaps. I think there is a purity about getting from A to B on a bike that's, has no fuss. Yeah. There's no moving from one form of transport to the other or relying on other people to sort of allow. It's perhaps a control thing.
Yeah. I don't know many architects who play golf.
No.
I'm just interested in why. I think that you're interesting in process and in the technology and in the kind of machinery and there's something beautiful, you might say, about cycling and that kit and about the kind of form and the language of cycling.
Yes, and navigating. Understanding that you're on a road, you're going from A to B. You know, we read...
Yeah.
We draw plans, we read maps, read a landscape and you take in an experience. And I suppose there is this sort of passive thing that you just want to consume as much of it as you possibly can. And ideally you'd be breathing fresh air. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Completely.
You've talked in a few other places about kind of some of the architects that have been... some of the architects who have kind of been most influential on your work. You said in one place you don't kind of idolise. Yeah, there seems to be a lot of people who...
Yeah, I've got this thing in my office and also in Doug and Morris. What I don't like doing is starting a project with loads of precedent. So this is a brief... This is a building by whoever it is.
Yeah.
Any one of the greats, Louis Kahn, whoever. Let's look at that. Or let's look at this sort of younger contemporary architect or this Swiss architect. I don't like that. I really don't want to be overly influenced by something that's already been built.
Yeah. You've not done much kind of renovation of existing build. Most of it's been new build.
Has been new build, yeah.
Right.
So I always want to get a project to a point where you've got an idea which is about where it is, the place, the site, the materials, the form, and then maybe you can start, if you really need to, start looking at other similar precedents, you know, perhaps how a plan has been broken down or what program has influenced. I just have this fear that there's too much, not copying, but a sort of passive copying, and everything just feels very fast now. There's a very, we make CGIs very quickly. Again, certain clients just say, give me my CGI day two if you designed it. Yeah. Why haven't you? Because you can get this guy who's got this great technology.
He'll do it overnight for you. Overnight. Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of that. So there's a lot of speed in demand coming from the client side.
Yeah.
And I think we're all doing that, whether we pretend we're not.
Yeah.
Is another yeah. thing, but it's just happening. We're just responding to information very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And maybe that's okay.
Yeah.
But for me, with, you know, we were talking about a project this morning and sort of thinking the next stage is what's the material?
Yeah.
So you're thinking, well, we need to line up 10 different materials and get the QS to cost per square meter yeah. rate and do this, that, and the other. And then I thought, no, we need to make something and look yeah. at the material and process something ourselves and think, what are we going to do with this? Yeah. Not what are we going to do with all that's come before yeah. and recycle it. So and maybe that summarizes what I'm trying to do with my practice, which is, you know, get my hands dirty again, not yeah. not slow things down, but actually make my own work and make my own decisions yeah. about what's interesting and sort of cultivate a studio which is hopefully a bit more original because yeah. of that. You know, if I can avoid CGIs at all, yeah, I will.
Yeah.
I would, but yeah. you can't. And there are practices who do them beautifully because they have to, and they've yeah. found a way to get their work represented yeah. in a CGI. But I don't know. I'd rather say this is my scribble. This is yeah. a kind of rough model, which is sort of what I think your building might be about, a wonderful mm-hmm. material or a different way of looking at things, or look how the light, look what the light does, but not this is it, this is exactly precisely to the, yeah. the light level on that day at that time of year, what you're going to get, because they're not going to get that.
No. We were talking earlier about craft and having an appreciation for craft and for things being kind of hand-built.
Yeah.
And maybe that idea about coming back to getting your hands dirty is
yeah,
is about coming back to that, really.
I did a ceramics course recently at
right.
UAL. Really getting I just really wanted dirty, yeah. to do it. And in my office, we're running an artist-in-residence program, so I've got someone coming in with a wheel.
Wow.
She's going to make pots. But she's going to make pots, maybe a dinner set or maybe yeah. a building with us, and we're going to talk about our domestic projects. And she's going to talk about her kind of domestic objects right. and we're going to try and fuse the two discussions and see what comes out of it. And then we're thinking yeah. about getting a florist in. Yeah. You know, who
we
knows?
Talk
it's,
to,
it's sort of...
A lot of people talking about architects, you talked a little bit about architect as developer and building your own house
yeah.
and
yeah.
we see a lot of architects doing that as a business model, but the branching out into other architects doing exhibition design, furniture
yeah.
design,
there's
yeah. a lot of scope for new creative
I think definitely. I mean, so many architects, no doubt when you speak to Annalise, she's you know, master at procuring
yeah.
their own projects, and there are I know lots of developer architects.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in that. I'm speaking to a school at the moment. It's a beautiful school, and they've got an amazing opportunity to develop a piece of it. Mm. And I've just gone in and said, I reckon you could do this.
Yeah.
Let's give it a go. And you know, why not?
You've been listening to Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse. My guest this week was Mary Duggan, founder and director of Mary Duggan Architects. You can find out more about Mary and her work at architecturemasters.org, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. You can send any comments, questions, or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.